Good afternoon to all of you. Wow, what a responsive group. This day is already a success. How many of you were in Germany this year for the feast? Can I see your hands? There are a few of you there. Now, there's one gentleman who is a little south of me, south of the Alps in Italy. He has a reputation for doing a lot of promotion for his feast site in Italy, Mr. Carmelo Anastasi. And I don't need to do that. I would just refer you to these individuals who just indicated that they were at the German feast site this year, and perhaps they'll put in a good word for us. We had a wonderful feast, as I'm sure you did too. The other guest speaker and I were discussing the order of our speaking today, who would speak first, and second, we decided it would be by coin toss. And I just want you to know, I wasn't present when the coin was tossed. I was informed that I would be first. And all three of us, our second guest speaker and your pastor and I, are longtime friends and former classmates at Ambassador College. And being the first of the three to speak, since I assume that your pastor will give the announcements today or make a few comments, since I'm the first of the three to speak, I've decided not to say anything about them. So they don't have a comeback, you know, on me, because they get the last word. I'd like to ask you a question to get started here. So the clock is running. My mother-in-law would have appreciated that. How many of you know what commandment number 6 is? The 6th commandment. We all do, right? Thou shalt not kill. Some theologians are linguistic experts debate whether the proper translation is kill or murder. That's not the point. The point that God is telling us is that, in a sense, only He, as life giver, has the right to take life. That prerogative is not given to us as human beings. So you might have surmised that that's going to be my subject today, the 6th commandment. And let me start off by asking another question. Following up with another question, how many of you have kept commandment number 6 in the last 3 months? Can I see a show of hands? How many of you have kept the 6th commandment? The last 6 months? The last year? Thou shalt not... Well, we're done. We've all kept the 6th commandment. Yes, I'm sure that none of us has killed anyone, at least physically, but we all know that there's more to the law of God than simply what we call, correctly, the letter of the law. There's also the spirit of the law, which is much more encompassing, all-encompassing. It has to do with our attitude, our heart, what goes on in our mind. And that's what we will be addressing today in my split sermon, the 6th commandment, the spirit of the law. Now, if we were going to go somewhere in the Bible to start examining the 6th commandment and the spirit of the law, let's think for a moment together. Where do you think we would go? What would be a good starting point? Who was the individual who, during his earthly ministry, expounded the spirit of the law? Jesus Christ, right? So where would we go in the teachings of Jesus to begin? Anybody want to venture a comment? Someone here? Matthew 5, Sermon on the Mount. Let's go there. That's what I have in my notes. Except in my notes it says Matthäus and not Matthew. Matthew chapter 5. When Jesus Christ was finished telling his disciples that he had not come to do away with the law, he had come to fulfill it, and he told them that their righteousness needed to be greater than that of the Pharisees and the scribes, in Matthew 5:17, in those verses, he told them, your righteousness has to be greater. And we think for a moment about the encounters that Jesus had with the Pharisees during his ministry, and we just wonder, were the Pharisees concerned about the law? Obviously they were. It was a big issue for them. So our righteousness has to be greater. And the very first example he gives, after having made that statement, has to do with commandment number 6, beginning in verse 21, Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said by them of old, thou shalt not kill, and whoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, continuing in verse 22, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, you fool, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. And Jesus goes on to tell us in verses 23 and 24 that this teaching is so important that if we want to bring a gift to an altar, we want to serve God, and we are aware of the fact that there's something not right in our heart toward our brother, we need to take care of that first. Now, verses 21 and 22 are quite interesting because they represent an increase in degree. Mathematics was not my strong suit in school. The humanities were things like languages, history. But I do remember one principle, and we'll apply that here in just a moment. If you have two equations, A equals B is your one equation, and in the second equation, in the other equation, you have one of those two, B equals C. Are you with me? A equals B, and B equals C. Well, then A also equals C, right? Because you have something that they both have in common that they're equal to. Notice what Jesus says in verse 21. He says, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not kill. Now he's talking here about the physical act of taking someone's life. And whosoever kills shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you in verse 22, as he begins to expound on the spirit of the law, that whoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. What Jesus says in verse 21 and the portion of verse 22 that we have just read are like those two equations, A equals B, B equals C. Both statements have one thing in common, and that is, if you read with me, the severity, let's call it the severity of the punishment, or the degree of the punishment is the same. In both cases, you are in danger of the judgment. In the one case, it's literally killing. In the other, it's bearing anger against your brother. And as it reads here, I think this is the King James I'm using today, without cause. Now, the Bible in other places tells us that if there is anger that is justified, it needs to be resolved. The Bible in the book of Ephesians chapter 4 tells us, don't let the sun go down upon your anger. Those types of situations need to be resolved very quickly. If you have unresolved anger and you bear anger in your heart towards another person, what does that anger over time become? If you read anything about psychology or the human mind and emotions and the way we work, that anger over time will turn into, bitterness. I heard another word. Hate. And what does the Bible tell us about hate? If we hate someone in our heart, it is the equivalent of killing. So that's why the judgment is the same in both of these cases. If we bear anger in our heart towards someone, we don't resolve it, it's going to lead eventually to a mental state where we will, in our mind, be doing the same thing via hate, through hate, as if we were killing someone. So if we do this, we are in danger of the judgment. It is as if Christ is saying we're putting guilt upon ourselves. We're transgressing. We're having to answer for something. And you'll notice then, as he continues on in verse 22, we now have an increase in the severity because it says, whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca shall be in danger of the council. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. Raca was an expression, if you read the commentaries, an expression of disgust, somewhat of a comparative expression, expressing to one degree or another that this other person is worth less, not worthless, but worth less than you, as if we are looking down on that person. We're up on high and we're having an attitude towards someone that is condemning in the sense that we view this person as being worth less than what we are. And that judgment is, that goes straight to the council. Now, when Jesus says council here, most likely he has in mind, bearing in mind his time, the context in which he lived, most likely he has in mind the Sanhedrin, the high court of Jewish religion in the first century A.D. So this offense is one that is more serious than just incurring judgment that, let's say, a lesser court or a lesser judge could have pronounced. This offense is serious enough that it goes straight to the highest court in the land, the Sanhedrin. And I'd like to give you an example of what Jesus may have meant, may have had in mind when he brought this example of looking down on someone else. Like your pastor, I happen to be a proud grandparent of three children, and especially, I don't know why that is, but our first grandson. We have two grandsons. They were born first, and now a granddaughter. They're ages 7, 4, and 1. And when our grandson was born, the 7-year-old, since he was the first, you kind of have a special place in your heart for that child. And on one occasion about 3 years ago, I was visiting our grandson. His name is Sean. And when Opa, I'm called Opa, the German word for grandpa, grandfather, when Opa is visiting, then Opa has to play with his grandkids. Now, if you're a grandparent, you know what this is. You know then, you realize how little you know because your grandchildren know all the rules of the games you play and you don't. So you're always told repeatedly, well, Opa, you didn't do this right. We have to do this again. So this was at a time when my grandson had just started preschool. He had been going to preschool about a couple of months, and we were playing one of his games, and Opa, me, yours truly, your guest speaker here today, made a mistake, and all of a sudden my grandson had this little jingle. He said, na, 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 you're dumb. I said, oh, Sean, that's kind of cute. Where did you come up with that? And he said, oh, they say that at school, you know, that it's something I just learned in preschool. When you do something wrong there, then the other kids start saying, na, 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 you're dumb, you know. I said, oh, okay, you learned something there. Now, we laugh at that. I thought it was a bit humorous, perhaps, at first. So we'll change the scene. The point I want to make is that that's perhaps how it starts. When my family and I lived in the Philippines from 1987 to 1994, the years that we served there, we lived in what you would call gated communities. That's where most Western visitors to a country like the Philippines, that's also true of other places like Malaysia, that's where you live. You live in a gated community. It's surrounded entirely by a wall, and there are entry points with armed guards. And if you don't live in a gated community as a Westerner and you leave your home to go to a Sabbath service or whatever, when you come home at evening, there won't be anything left in your house. That's just the reality of life at times in places like that. So we lived in this gated community, and right next door to us, there was a German family. The father was employed by the German embassy. He was a consular official. And all of the other people living on the street where we lived were wealthy Filipinos. And when I say wealthy, I mean wealthy. These people had live-in maids and drivers, and that's just the lifestyle for those who are wealthy. Well, across the street from us, one of these Filipino families had a dog with a mean temper. And our German neighbors, their maid was out in the street one day emptying a bucket of water, and this dog from across the street was not in the house compound. Even the houses have walled walls around the property. The dog was out in the street, and the dog came over and bit her in the arm and took a chunk out of her skin. So our German neighbors took this lady, their maid, to the hospital, and she had stitches and all of that. And several days later, the German fellow went over to the neighbor across the street and wanted to bring this up and ask that the neighbor reimburse him for the expense he had had in having her wound taken care of, because after all, it was his dog. So this fellow went across the street and explained the situation and asked to be reimbursed. And the neighbor said, "What are you so worried about anyway? After all, she's just a maid." Na, 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 na. You're dumb. You see, you begin to, not you, but perhaps that's where it starts. You begin to categorize people as having less worth. You begin to look down on them. And Jesus said that's a very dangerous mental situation, because in God's sight, all human beings have, let's say, equal right. When he calls them and he begins to work with them and he opens their minds and makes the Holy Spirit accessible to them, we all have equal right to be a part of the family of God. That doesn't deny or gainsay the fact that there are different abilities and talents. We know that the Bible addresses that. Jesus himself does in one of the parables of the Bible. But to consider someone in that way of lesser worth is a judgment, in the words of Jesus Christ, that immediately brings us in danger of having to hear to appear before the highest court because of our attitude. And he goes on to say in verse 22, if we continue his thought, he now reaches the climax of his comparisons here when he says, "But whosoever shall say, 'Thou fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." Thou fool. For the Jewish society of the first century A.D., if you read the commentaries, the term fool was used in reference to someone who rebelled against God, someone who had fallen away, someone who was not loyal to God. So in other words, it appears that Jesus here is depicting an attitude when we would, in our mind, assign someone to missing out on eternal life. We would say in our minds, this person isn't going to make it. They're not going to be there. And perhaps coupled with what he says in the preceding comparison, even thinking perhaps, well, they don't deserve to be there. That mental state of mind, in Jesus' mind, all of these having to do with the spiritual application of the sixth commandment is so serious that he says, we've made ourselves in danger of hellfire. I think most of us understand a few of the Greek terms that are used in the Bible. So if we were to look at this in the original Greek, what word do you think we might find in the Greek where we read here in the English Bible, hell, hellfire? Anybody want to take a stab at it? What word do you think we might find there in the Greek? Anybody? Gehenna. Right on. Spot on. Gehenna, the word used in the New Testament and New Testament Greek to describe that all-consuming fire which will destroy the wicked. So that attitude is so serious that we are in danger of incurring that judgment upon ourselves. So there's a lot more to the sixth commandment than simply fulfilling the letter of the law, "Thou shalt not kill." I think we would all agree that we've all come here today, and none of us has to be concerned that any one of us is going to violate the sixth commandment by our actions. You don't have to worry that I'm going to somehow leave the lectern here, the pulpit, and come out and do anything to you. It's as if I was at home and made up my mind. I meditated on this when Mr. McNeely asked me to come here as a guest speaker. I'm going to keep the sixth commandment. No, we don't have to be concerned about that. But Jesus tells us there are other things we need to direct our attention to. So the sixth commandment is much more encompassing than simply not doing something. As a matter of fact, as we transition now to our next point, the sixth commandment has to do with what we actually do, what we actually do instead of what we don't do. And that's an interesting aspect of the spiritual application of the law of God. It's not a passive thing. Don't do something. It also entails what we should be doing. And to understand that, we'll turn to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. And read an example here out of the life and ministry of Jesus Christ that deals primarily with the Sabbath day, the day which we observe, the day upon which we've come together, Luke chapter 6, and we'll read verses 6 to 11. Very familiar example out of the life of Jesus Christ. Verse 6, it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue, Luke 6, verse 6, and taught. And there was a man whose right hand was withered. We all know the story in verse 7. The scribes and Pharisees were watching him. They wanted to see what is he going to do because they wanted to make an accusation. They wanted to have grounds to accuse him of something. But he knew their thoughts, verse 8. And he said to the man which had the withered hand, "Rise up and stand forth in the midst." And he arose and stood forth. Then Jesus said to them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil?" Now bear in mind, as I mentioned just a moment ago, the primary focus of this example is the Sabbath day itself. We don't want to lose sight of that. We want to be honest with the Scripture. That's the example Jesus is talking about. What is permissible or what is allowed on the Sabbath day? But as a secondary train of thought and the example Jesus gives us, he continues on to say, here in verse 9, is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil? And then he says, to save life or to destroy it. So a secondary point of view in this example would be an application of commandment number 6, because that's the commandment that says, thou shalt not kill. Now let's pause there for a moment and think about this man whose hand was withered. The Bible says he was already a man, so he was an adult. He was grown up. We don't learn anything more about him, to my knowledge, from the parallel accounts. We don't know if he was born with this withered hand, or perhaps if he became a leper, or what the situation was when this condition arose. But apparently he had lived some time already with this withered hand, perhaps even from birth. So ask yourself the question, when Jesus asks the question here, to save life or to destroy it, was this man's life in danger? Had he just been in an accident, was lying there bleeding to death? Did he need immediate attention, medical attention, because he was suffering and about to die? The answer is no. He had reached adult life with this withered hand. But the comparison is interesting. Here again, you have two equations where you have one thing that's in common. To do good or evil, to save life. To save life is, and to do good are the component that they share, both equations, or to destroy it. And we know what happens next. Jesus healed the man's hand. So what did he do? He did not destroy life. He saved life. He fulfilled the sixth commandment in one sense. He contributed to the life quality that this individual was able to have by giving him a healed hand. A hand that was fully able to be used just as the other one was. So if we think about that for a moment, spiritually speaking, when it comes to the application of the sixth commandment in the spirit, the opposite of killing is not killing. In other words, doing nothing. I'm not going to kill anyone. I'm not going to do anything. The opposite of killing, according to the spirit of the law, is to contribute to someone having a, let's say, a better life. A life with a greater quality of life. And then we deduct that from what Jesus asks at the conclusion of verse 9, to save life or to destroy it. In this particular case, the man was not in danger of dying. His life was not at stake, but he did not have the quality of life that our Heavenly Father intended for us to have. Jesus took care of that. He contributed to this man having a full quality of physical human life. Now, you and I won't be able to do that, I think. Won't be able to walk around as Jesus did and heal people. But if we consider the sixth commandment in this sense, there's a lot of ways we can contribute to other people having a fuller life. You know, if you look at the Ten Commandments in their sequence, beginning with the first commandment, we're to have no other gods beside the true God. The second commandment then, in a way, begins to expound on that worship of the true God by telling us what is acceptable for that true God. We're not to worship Him using any physical tool or help, an idol or whatever. And the third commandment continues to expound how we worship that one true God. Well, perhaps if we look at the second six commandments in a similar way, we see that commandment number 5, as we know, which introduces the second six, we shall honor father and mother, is very similar to commandment number 1. It directs us to our own human parents and the proper respect we are to show them. And then as we get into our interpersonal relationships, the first commandment we're given is this sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. So if we refrain from killing, we haven't fulfilled it. We have to do more than that. Well, think about the commandments that follow. Thou shalt not commit adultery, commandment number 7. We shouldn't steal. We shouldn't bear false witness. We shouldn't covet. I submit for your consideration, we don't have time to analyze all of those in detail, but each of those commandments has a life-enhancing aspect building on commandment number 6 that goes beyond simply not doing these things. We not only don't commit adultery, for example, with commandment number 7, we contribute to others having a happy marriage, helping them in whatever way we can. We not only not steal, we not only refrain from taking something from someone, we contribute as we can to the quality of life they have, and so on. We not only don't bear false witness against our neighbor, we build our neighbor up through positive encouragement. They all have a positive action component, the spirit of the law. Let's go to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. And we'll read verses 13 to 21. Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21. Here Jesus has been teaching, and then one of those who had been listening to him said to him, verse 13, Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me, as if Jesus was, you know, a negotiator or whatever, a mediator. And he said to him in verse 14, Who made me a judge or a divider over you? And he said unto them, most likely recognizing the actual attitude of this man's heart, Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things which he possesses. And he gave them a parable. We've read this parable, I'm sure, many times. The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, What shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? So he comes up with this idea. He's already got more than what he needs, more than enough. So his idea is, I'm going to tear down the barns I already have. Most likely, my commentary, they were in good shape. They didn't need to be replaced as far as their physical condition was concerned. And I'm going to build greater ones, bigger ones. And there I'm going to store all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Now notice what God says to him. Thou fool, this night your soul shall be required of you, your life. Then whose shall those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Some people interpret this parable to mean that this rich man was not willing or interested in sharing his goods with God. In some cases, I've heard this particular parable interpreted in the sense of this individual wasn't tithing or he wasn't supporting the work of God in a proper way. And so God says to him, this night, in this very night, you're going to die. And Jesus' summary in verse 21 is, so is he that lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. But consider the aspect of the sixth commandment we're talking about today. There's nothing in the words of the rich man where he was thinking about those who were less fortunate than he was. Those where he could have contributed to an improvement in the quality of life that they were experiencing. Everything he had was just for himself. Let's also remember that when Jesus Christ was asked, which commandment is the greatest in the law? He answered with two commandments. The first commandment being that we are to love the Lord our God with all of our being, if I may shorten it or paraphrase it. And then he says, and the second one is, and I don't remember what the English says right here, but in the German Bible it says the second one is equal to the first one. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. So someone who isn't being rich toward God is not fulfilling God's will in many areas of their life. Also in the context of what they're willing to do for their neighbor. And this fellow wasn't willing to do anything. I find it very interesting what God says to this person. God said unto him, what did God tell him? What does God call him? You fool. You remember what we read in Matthew chapter 5? Of the three stages of spiritually breaking or transgressing against the sixth commandment, this is the third. You know, when we refer to someone else that way, you fool, you worthless human being, profligate, you've turned away from God. Well, that's what God says about this individual. You fool, you are in danger of Gehenna fire because you think only about yourself. You're not concerned about anyone else, not interested in contributing to the quality of life that they have or may not have. So this individual, among other things, he was not only greedy and coveting for himself, he was not fulfilling the spiritual intent of the sixth commandment. I don't know what your situation is in the United States, because I've spent most of my adult life outside the United States in service to the church. And we have had in several cases in the last 20 or 25 years, individuals in the German language area who had the opposite attitude of this person described here, this rich man with his great possessions. There's also the poor man who doesn't fulfill the sixth commandment, and he chooses to do so purposefully. We've had individuals in Europe, members of the church, who have decided simply to get out of society, go back to the land, And I have one individual that I think of often who, with his wife and small children, moved from a metropolitan area where the husband, the father, had a good job, and he wanted to do everything by the natural way. So he refused to have any kind of what we might consider today normal heating in his house. He chopped wood, he planted and sowed, and everything they ate was from their own garden. Now, those aren't necessarily wrong goals, but that consumed so much of his time, so much effort to do these things, he had no time for anybody else, and yet he chose to live that way. There are those who choose to have the absolute minimum in life, so they're free to do whatever they want, and they too, it's the inverse of this individual Jesus is describing here, they too fail to contribute to fulfilling the spiritual intent of the sixth commandment because they could do more if they chose to do something else. Would like to mention in that regard the environment, because this particular individual I'm thinking of, in his mind, environmental causes were very important, and I think they are to all of us. Each of us as individuals should do what we can to preserve the environment. You know, if we preserve the environment, we're not only honoring our Creator God in heaven in some small way, we're also contributing to the quality of life of our fellow man. So indirectly, we're talking once again about the sixth commandment. But you and I, as needed, as necessary as our efforts might be in this area of environmental protection, you and I are not going to solve the environmental problem by our actions. That situation can only be solved by a global effort, a global solution. And that's one of the things that Jesus Christ is going to take care of when he returns. If you read Revelation chapter 11 and verse 18, those who destroy the earth will be punished. They're going to be called into account. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. We'll read verses 26 to 28. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 to 28, the Apostle Paul says, "Be angry and sin not." This is what we were talking about at the beginning of the split sermon. "Let not the sun go down upon your wrath." So that kind of anger needs to be dealt with quickly on the same day it arises. "Neither give place to the devil." Don't give Satan, the devil, an opportunity. Don't open the door for him. He's kind of like the Fuller Brush Man, the way we used to joke about that. If he gets his foot in the door, you're going to have a hard time getting it shut. And in the context of Scripture, what he's talking about is having an angry attitude. Now, I find it very interesting that in the context of this admonition, the very next thing that Paul says in verse 28 is, "Let him that stole steal no more." So if we go back to what we read in Luke 6, if I steal from someone, am I contributing to the quality of life that they have? Or am I diminishing it? Obviously, I'm diminishing it. I'm not contributing to improving their life. And Jesus mentions this right after talking about being angry, a mental state that Jesus himself tied into transgressing the sixth commandment in the spirit. "So let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him who is in need." Obviously, verse 28 is talking primarily about commandment number 8, "Thou shalt not steal," but it is a reminder that by honest labor and our efforts, we are in a position that we may be able to help others, those who have need. So we contribute to improving the quality of their life and extrapolating on what Jesus said in Luke chapter 6 about the fellow with the withered hand, contributing to someone having a better life, making their life more livable, is actually the inverse, the opposite of killing, transgressing the sixth commandment in the letter of the law. So when we ask the question, as we did at the beginning of this message this afternoon, what is the sixth commandment? And have I been keeping the sixth commandment, which we all have been? We saw that by a show of hands. My purpose today was to give us food for thought about the spiritual side of the sixth commandment, what it entails in our attitude toward our fellow human being, and what it entails in terms of what we actually do, instead of concentrating in our thoughts on a passive mode where we want to confirm the fact, yes, I've kept the sixth commandment. I haven't killed anyone. That's easy. We can all say that. So next time someone asks you, or you ask yourself, have I been keeping the sixth commandment? I trust now you'll have a little more to think about in answering your question. Look forward to visiting with all of you afterwards. I don't know how long we'll be here, but nice to be here. Very friendly group, and appreciate your response.